Speaker. John Kerry, one-time editor of the Militant, one-time organizer of the New York City Branch, one-time editor of the West Coast Maritime newspaper, one-time member of the Maritime, the Marine Firemen's Oilers and Water Teachers Union, and an educator, and still is. Is keeping up with the revolutionary task, how to best organize, educate, and inspire the American working class to change and dismantle this society that puts property rights over human rights. In 1944, when the central leadership of the Socialist Workers Party was sent to prison, there were very few revolutionaries left. One of them happened to be Tom Kerry. Him and the other leaders left with the inexperienced members and the young members had to confront and had to meet the new opportunities and challenges of the party. And this leadership became the editors, the business managers, and they organized and all of the functions of the party to make it run as smooth as a well-oiled machine. And this was accomplished because there was a continuity in the leadership of the party. The new leaders had learned from the older and more experienced leaders, and they in turn taught and inspired the inexperienced to keep building a revolutionary party. To learn from past experiences and from past history, and to understand what is possible and necessary in a given situation, and what is not possible and what is not necessary, are some of the lessons Tom Kerry has been teaching several generations of the Socialist Workers Party. Tonight, he'll be speaking about the emerging revolt of U.S. labor. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce Tom Kerry to you.
Comrade chairperson, comrade and friend. The topic of tonight's talk is the emerging revolt of U.S. labor. But in the talk that will be given in three segments, or rather two now, an integrated whole divided into three parts. I will deal with the question of whether or not there is anything in the history and tradition of the American working class that gives us confidence that they are capable of performing their historical task, which is to overthrow capitalism and to establish a new socialist party. This concept has been challenged, especially by the so-called new left, who insists that it's necessary now to engage in a search for a new agency of social change. The organized working class, they contend, must be considered as part of the establishment, if you please. And that is one of the things that we've got to demolish, and which I hope in my talk this evening will provide at least some measure of confidence in our view that the American working class history and tradition points in the direction of their eminent capability of performing not only their historical task, but leading the way for the revolution on a world scale. Now, for the purposes of our of background to our discussion tonight, I would like to begin with what I consider a major turning point in the American trade union movement. It is a struggle for the shorter work day in the latter part of the 19th century, 18 in the 1880s. The American Federation of Labor was organized in the year 1886, a year which ushered in the great class battles around the issues of the 8-hour day, a struggle that peaked with the Haymarket Massacre, a deliberate police provocation of a peaceful demonstration for the shorter work day. This gave rise to a movement which was consummated in the establishment of May Day as an international workers' holiday by the Second International in the year 1892. In a letter from London, Friedrich Engels wrote to an American Marxist, Florence Kelly, Mrs. Wisniewski. She married Dr. Wisniewski, a Marxist, under date of June 3rd, 1886, and I quote, "Whatever the mistakes of the leaders of the movement," speaking about the American movement now, "and partly of the newly awakening masses too, one thing is certain. The American working class is moving, and no mistake. And after a few false starts, they will get into the right track soon enough. This appearance of the Americans I consider one of the greatest events of the year," writes Engels, and he continues. "What the downbreak of Russian Tsarism would be for the great military monarchies of Europe, the snapping of their mainstay, that is for the bourgeois of the whole world, the breaking out of class war in America. For America, after all, is the ideal of all bourgeois, a country rich, vast, expanding, with purely bourgeois institutions unleavened by feudal remnants of monarchical traditions and without a permanent and hereditary proletariat. Here," continues Engels, "everyone could become, if not a capitalist, at all events an independent man, producing or trading with his own means for his own account. And because there were not as yet classes with opposing interests, our and your bourgeois thought that America stood above class antagonism and class struggles. The delusion has not broken down. The last bourgeois paradise on earth, in fact, is fast changing into a purgatorio, and can only be prevented from becoming, like Europe, an inferno by the go-ahead pace at which the development of the newly fledged proletariat of America will take place. The way in which they have made their appearance on the scene is quite extraordinary. 6 months ago, nobody suspected anything, and now they appear all of a sudden in such organized masses as to strike terror into the whole capitalist class." And Engels concludes on a rather pensive note. "I only wish," he says, "I only wish Marx could have lived to see." Now both Marx and Engels and Lenin and Trotsky and all the great Marxists made predictions which took longer than had been anticipated at the beginning, and that is only because they saw so much further that events looked a lot closer to them. But nothing in what Engels has said in the history or tradition of the American working class need be changed by a single syllable up to the present day. An indication of the tenor of those times is the following excerpt from the preamble, and you won't believe this, of the Constitution of the Founding Convention of the American Federation of Labor, which read, quote, "A struggle is going on in all the nations of the civilized world between the oppressors and the oppressed of all countries. A struggle between capital and labor, which must grow in intensity from year to year and work disastrous results to the toiling millions of all nations if they are not combined for mutual protection and benefit." One of the little ironies of history, this preamble, which I just quoted to you, written in the spirit and language of class struggle, remained ensconced in the AFL Constitution until the Unity Convention between the AFL and CIO in 1955, when it was unceremoniously jettisoned. That didn't mean that the American Federation of Labor continued to be a class struggle organization until that time. No, no. Everyone knows otherwise. But as degenerate as the bureaucrats become, they didn't have the gall to eliminate the preamble from their founding convention constitution until given the pretext by the Unity Convention of 1955. The American trade union movement was born in struggle, ferocious, uncompromising struggle. It was nurtured in struggle. It was weaned in struggle. And despite its several detours into the swamp of class collaboration, the union ranks still remain imbued with the tradition of struggle. Of this aspect of American unionism, Jack Barbash, author, ex-union official, labor expert, liberal, etc., etc., writes in his book entitled The Practice of Unionism, published in 1956, some 20 years ago, and I quote, "No political democracy has offered a more hostile environment to unionism than has the United States. And this hostility has imparted to American unionism a character and a temper unlike those of any other labor movement in the world." Of the numerous attempts in the pre-CIO days to organize the workers in the mass production industries, Barbash writes, quote, "Whatever major sorties into mass production union organization were attempted were repulsed with primitive violence and passion by industry and, in behalf of industry, by government." It is ironic, Barbash observes, that a labor movement which went to such lengths to divorce itself from revolutionary ideologies should have been met with such systematic and calculated oppression when it ventured forth from its strongholds of organization in the building service and small employer unit metal trades into the fastness of steel, coal, textiles, etc. Is it possible, he asks, is it possible to find in the history of the radical-minded labor organizations of Europe chapters comparable to Homestead, where in 1892 an armed battle took place between 300 Pinkertons hired by the Carnegie Steel Company and the striking workers? to the anthracite strike of 1902, during which the leading coal operator wrote to a minister pleading for some concession to the striking miners. Quote, "The rights and interests of a laboring man," he said, "will be protected and cared for, not by the labor agitators, but by the Christian men to whom God in his infinite wisdom has given control of the property interests of this country." He goes on to bloody Ludlow in 1913, where during the coal strike in the Colorado Fuel and Iron Corporation, a rock star concern, a congressional investigating committee reported, quote, "that government existed in southern Colorado only as an instrument of tyranny and oppression in the hands of the operator." To the 1919 steel strike, in which one labor strike-breaking detective agency employed by the steel industry instructed its operatives to, quote, "call up every question you can in reference to the racial hatred between these two nationalities, the Serbians and the Italians." And Bardash concludes, "to know that these are not exceptional illustrations selected for their shocking qualities, one must go through the 70-odd volumes, that's 70 of the hearings of the Senate Civil Liberties Committee, headed by Senator La Follette, and to draw the inevitable conclusion that the corporations which use professional spies, strike breakers, and terrorists represented the aristocracy, if you please, the aristocracy of American industry. And they became our typical aristocrats. That they were the aristocracy par excellence from the Carnegies and Rockefellers of the early 20th century to the Tom Girdlers of Republic Steel who mounted the Memorial Day massacre in the Calumet District of Chicago in 1937. Crime for which they'll pay, and pay heavily, in a not too distant future. Only with the outbreak of World War I was a, quote, moratorium, unquote, on the class struggle declared in deference to the spirit of national unity, in pursuit of the goal of winning what was then dubbed the war to end all wars, the war for democracy. That was World War I. Many of you young people were not alive then. I remember. The war for democracy. In the whole historical period prior to Roosevelt's New Deal of the 1930s, Farbash observes, quote, "only during World War I did the unions encounter a measure of toleration. But this required the active intervention of the federal government in behalf of collective bargaining, a development with mixed consequences since it served as a spur to company unions." And what was the reward bestowed upon the unions for their wartime self-abnegation and patriotism? After the war, notes Farbash, the lid was on unionism again. Hostility of employers, understudied by government, continued unabated. Even the prosperity of the middle 20s, he observes, failed to encourage anything like a corresponding upswing in the growth of unionism, which, in my view, is a masterpiece of understatement. So let's hear from a less reticent, a less timid source on precisely the kind of gratitude bestowed upon the American workers by the victorious imperialist warlords of World War I. In a collection of his writings published by Pathfinder Press, entitled Speeches for Socialism, Tim Cannon recalls in a speech on the coming American Revolution that, and I quote, "After the successful termination of the First World War to make the world safe for democracy, the ruling class of America embarked on a furious reactionary campaign to break the Union, to establish the open shop, and to suppress all forms of labor radicalism. In the Palmer Red Raids of 1919, hundreds of political meetings were broken up, and thousands of radical workers were arrested. Hundreds were sent to prison. Whole shiploads of foreign-born workers were deported. The newly found Communist Party was savagely persecuted. Its leaders were arrested and indicted, and the party was driven underground." Simultaneously, Cannon continues, the steel strike was broken. Now, this is the steel strike of 1919. Pardon me where I pour it. In part by ruthless violence, and in part by the wholesale importation of strikebreakers, unions newly formed during the war were broken up and scattered right and left. The railway shopman strike was defeated in 1922. American capitalism, smashing all opposition before it, marched confidently into the strikeless open shop paradise of the great boom of the 20s. And Jim tells only a small part of the whole story of strike breaking and union busting by the employers and their political henchmen at all levels of government, local, state, and national. There was, for example, the maritime strike of 1921, where the seamen and the ship owners reached an agreement and were prepared to go back to work, and the government intervene and says, any ship owner that signs an agreement with the union will be deprived of all subsidy, which meant bankruptcy for the ship owner. Compelled them to lock the seamen out and smash the union and establish the think halls in the open shop of the maritime industry. And then there was the shipyard strike in Seattle in 1919, which developed into a general strike, the first citywide general strike in the history of this country. It was in Seattle in 1919, as an outgrowth of the shipyard strike, and there again, the shipyards, which were built by the government to build ships during the war, reached an agreement with the union. And the government says, if you sign this agreement, we'll shut these shipyards down, because they belong to the politicians in Washington. And they organized the strike-breaking movement that broke the Seattle strike and then the Seattle general strike. Now, they paid for this some 13 years later, in 1934, because it was precisely these seamen and these men from the woods in Seattle and the Seattle labor movement who spearheaded the movement on the West Coast Water Fund in 1934 and smashed every attempt on the part of the employers and the government to break their strike. They'd gone through the experience and they learned their lessons and they put those lessons to work in 34, And the same thing is going to be happening again. With the military victory in World War I against their imperialist rivals, and their successful union-busting crusade to smash the American workers' organizations and atomize the American labor force, the ruling class was riding high, wide, and handsome. As Jim Cannon tells it in his speech, and I quote, "The American bourgeoisie entered the great boom of the 20s with the exuberant confidence and enthusiasm of alchemists who had finally discovered the philosopher's stone, which turns everything into gold, glittering gold. In that golden age of American capitalism, a new school of bourgeois economists came from the colleges to proclaim the glad tidings that Marx had been refuted by Henry Ford, who was offering $5 a day for his workers in his slave shop in Detroit. $5 a day, unheard of. That American business genius, I'm quoting, that American business genius had discovered the secret of full employment." Now, this is just before the October crash. "Had discovered the secret of full employment and permanent prosperity without interfering with the private ownership of the means of production, but on the contrary, strengthening it and aiding its concentration. They continue to beat the drums," Cannon reports, "on this same theme up to the year, the month, and even the day when the stupendous myth of the 20s was exploded in the stock market crash of 1929. The very week in which the whole structure came tumbling down, the most learned articles were published in the name of the most eminent college professors," you all excuse me, this environment is not conducive to criticism of college professors, but I cannot help myself. I must tell the truth. "Explaining that this prosperity was going to go higher and would continue endlessly. But ended in, and not with a whimper, but with a cataclysmic crash. At the time of the crash, the AFL numbers some 3 million members. That was the total organized, with the exception of a few independent unions, strength of the American working class. 3 million men. Barbash reports that by way of compensation, in quotation marks, for their failure to organize large-scale industry, quote, the unions made the most of their relatively favorable position in the trades and industries in which small-scale business predominated. Only the privileged few, the aristocracy of labor, enjoyed the benefits of organization. With the onslaught of the Depression, following the stock market crash, the number fell to less than 2 million. Now, it's very difficult at this late date to describe adequately the impact that this crash had upon the people of this country. For a whole period, it sent the people into what could only be described as a state of shock. There are no such thing as unemployment insurance, no social security, no public welfare, no Medicare, no Medicaid, no nothing, except private charity. Private charity. And then look at that. Soup kitchens by the Salvation Army and hunger meals by the tens of thousands. The first stirrings, as a result of the Depression, were among the unemployed. And then primarily those in the communities who would rally to the aid of their fellow unemployed, who were being evicted by the sheriff and his deputies, as the sheriff would evict an unemployed family for failure to pay rent, the other unemployed would move the furniture back in. It was out of this process that the first unemployed organizations developed and grew. Outside of the union, there was no heat on the part of the American Federation of Labor of any interest in the unemployed. There were enough interest in those who were members, let alone unemployed, that they considered different. Roosevelt's New Deal, the National Recovery Act, and Section 7A of the National Labor Relations Act, constituted the beginning of a turning point, a temporary revival in the year 1933-34. Roosevelt, you remember, was elected in 1932 on a program that differed very little from Hoover. It was under the impact, really, of the horrible crisis of the banks and was closing down all over the country. The big bank holiday, all the banks of the entire country was shut down. I personally had some very unfortunate experiences. Did you ever have a bank close right in your face? I did. That was, I was in line trying to get my savings out, and by the time the first person in front of me had withdrawn, the thing went down, there's no more money. And I still have the papers at home on what they owe me. Not very much, but when socialism comes around, I'm going to use some money for payment. And say, this is what the capitalists took away from me in 1933. How about, well, it was 10%. It began by the key device of priming the pump prime, as the PWA Public Works Administration and WPA Works Project Administration, which was later, the CCC Civilian Conservation Corps, that is the young people would be taken and put in camps and sent out to period like the desert. Practically half the desert, all of the roads in the desert were built by the kids in the CCC camps. And exist to this very day, as well as a lot of very useful public work. And it's through this that the revival of economic life in this country. Outside of the unemployed, that aspect of the unemployed action that I described, the first successful product of militant class struggle action came as a result of the direct intervention of the various radical tendencies. It was the radicals who first began to mobilize and organize workers in unions on the basis of the class struggle. In Minneapolis, it was the Trotskyists and the Teamsters. In Toledo, it was the AWP, American Workers' Party, the Muskie Group, in the Autolite strike, which was a lost strike. The strike was lost until the AWP mobilized its unemployed organization to defy the injunction. It was a common practice of the judges in those days, the moment there was a strike, for the boss to go to court and get an injunction against the strikers, and if they defied the injunction, they'd be thrown into prison, in jail. Teach them a lesson. The Muskieites mobilized their unemployed, went down to the picket line. After the picket line, the scabs were going through. The strike was broke. And they were circling an injunction. And they went to jail. And because of the mobilization of the unemployed around the jailhouse and around the judge, they were released. And from the jail, they went back to the picket line and mobilized 10,000 around that plant. And in a couple of days, they settled and they recognized the union and won the strike. A new element, aspect of the class struggle entered into the consciousness of the American workers in their struggle. And on the Pacific coast, I've already indicated, the Communist Party, which was then just emerging from its third period of ultra-leftism after the victory of Hitler in Germany. The IWW, which was strong in the woods and in the maritime and on the ships. Syndicalists of European type, like Harry Lundberg of the Sailors Union, who was not an IWW, he was a European syndicalist. The difference, let me just talk for a moment. European syndicalists did not believe in the organization of revolutionary industrial unions, independent of the general union movement. Their concept was of the militant minority, the organization of the militant minority within the body of the union movement, and the struggle for leadership over the unions. Almost something like our fraction, our concept of fraction of the union. The veterans of the general strike of Seattle and of the broken, of the 1921 maritime strike was broken for the veterans of the Delta by the government. These all constituted the leadership of this strike. The strike movement. The strike opened up as a longshore strike. The other maritime crafts joined in, supported the longshore. And it ended up in the San Francisco general strike, when the cops attacked the strikers and killed two of them, and beat back the attack of the employers and the let us hear from a friend, in quotation marks, on this score, Sidney Lemons, who recently wrote an article published in the April 1977 issue of the Progressive magazine published in Wisconsin, on the recent Sadowski election campaign. That's what the article is about, and its import for the future. It's entitled The Coming Revolt in Labor, with a subtitle which reads, quote, Ed Sadowski lost the steelworkers' elections, but the future lies with his movement. And we'll return to this subject a little later in our talks. Let me read it to you again. Ed Sadowski lost the steelworkers' election, but the future lies with his movement. We have the distinction. Amen. Lemons was a former member of our party in the early 1930s, and was a supporter of the older faction. There was an ultra-left grouping that split with the party over the tactic of entry into the Socialist Party, carried through under the prompting of Trotsky in the year 1936. Here is his view of the 1934 strike movement given in the above-mentioned article. Quote, in 1933, says Lenz, as American free enterprise was being transformed into controlled capitalism, I don't know what he means by that, it's one of the new left terms he picked up somewhere. A moribund AFL, which still opposed welfare and unemployment compensation as doles, that robbed workers of their initiative, was beset by a band of radicals who insisted on a different brand of unionism. Only this motley force of communists, socialists, Trotskyists, and former Wobblies who were prepared to work outside the system if the system refused them a legitimate channel to redress their grievances, who have led the great strikes of the 1930s. John L. Lewis, Sidney Hillman, David Dubinsky, and other labor statesmen took the vows, but they did not do the organizing or lead the work stoppages. The three major strikes of 1934, Haynes continues, which gave a vital thrust to the labor breakthrough, were civil wars in microcosm. Harry Bridges' longshoremen formed into 1,000-man picket lines on the San Francisco Embarcadero and violently resisted police attempts to reopen the port. The Toledo Auto Rights strike was saved from collapse by Sam Pollock, Art Price, Ted C. Lander, and other members of A.J. Mustey's American Workers' Party, who led unemployed supporters in violating injunctions and fighting off 900 National Guardsmen. And it was not very long after that the American Workers' Party and the Communist League of America, which is the name of our party in 1934, fused into one party, which was then called the Workers' Party, which later entered into the Socialist Party, and in 1938 formed the Socialist Workers' Party, when it fused with the left wing of the Socialist Party. That's history in microcosm. He continues. Strikers in Minneapolis walkouts, Lenin's continues, led by Farrell Dodds, the Dunn brothers, and other Trotskyists, used flying squads in military formation to challenge the police. End of quote. And now, with all due allowance for some literary embellishment, Lenz tells it like it was. As he indicates, Lewis, the head of the mine workers and the head of the CIA, later the head of the CIO, Newman, the head of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, Dubinsky, the head of the International Lady Garment Workers, and other labor statesmen of their ilk were convinced that unless the AFL moved to organize the workers in the mass production industries into industrial unions, the radical left wing of the labor movement would proceed to fill the leadership vacuum. They were convinced. The 1934 strike served to reinforce that conviction and spurred the formation, first, of a committee for industrial organization within the AFL, and later led to the split and the formation of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO. The labor upsurge of the early 1930s will go down in American history as one of the great social upheavals of the 20th century. Of the objective prerequisites for the social revolution were present, save one: the lack of a mass revolutionary leadership capable of carrying through to the very end the aspiration of the surging masses for a fundamental social change. You will recall this was true not only in this country but on a world scale. You will remember that Trotsky, in the opening sentence of his monumental work, The Transition Program, declares, and I quote, "The world political situation as a whole," this is written in 1938, "the world political situation as a whole is chiefly characterized by a historical crisis of the leadership of the proletariat. All of the exploited and oppressed look to the CIO as their champion. They saw in the CIO..."